Well, after dark this evening, skies should be clear to partly cloudy for some number of hours, much of the time before midnight, it appears, to enable you to see the supermoon. Tonight, as you probably have heard, the moon will be the closest to the Earth that it's been since 1948. And astronomers say that the full moon will actually be brighter than others. Fearing a cloudy night tonight, I went out last night shortly after dark, and the moon looked, a full moon always looks pretty dramatic. It always looks beautiful to me. How noticeable it will be that, the added brightness, how noticeable that will be, I have no idea. But we're going to try to take it in again here tonight, the supermoon. It'll be decades before it's this close again, too, by the way. Its current state here on Monday. I'm Mark Bayshore. Nolan Finley is the editorial page editor at the Detroit News. During the course of the 2016 election season, his takes on the rise of Donald Trump and his post-election columns on his victory in the presidential election have provided readers with much food for thought regarding how this happened and what could happen next. Recently, the News endorsed Libertarian Gary Johnson for president, thereby not endorsing the Republican nominee for the first time in the paper's 143-year history. We invite Nolan back to Current State to learn more about his observations during this controversial election. Welcome back, Nolan Finley.
Thank you, Mark. I appreciate it.
Well, our listeners have been hearing a lot about the appointments of Reince Priebus as Donald Trump's chief of staff and Steve Bannon as his senior counselor. But before we get into some of these other topics and other things you've written about, what do you make of these appointments?
Well, I think a president is always going to put closest to him, at least in the beginning, the people who helped him get elected. So I'm not at all surprised. I think what we've got to be prepared for is that every time Donald Trump makes an appointment, there is going to be much gnashing of teeth. And I think I've taken a wait-and-see attitude about this. Reince Priebus certainly gave him good help and good counsel during the campaign, and I think that's what he'll be looking for during his presidency, during his administration.
Last Thursday, your column was headlined, GOP Don't Gorge on Total Power. This election means, of course, that one party, the Republicans, will control the White House and both chambers of Congress. Talk to us about your concerns with that.
Well, that's both a blessing and a curse. It's a blessing in that there certainly is no reason for gridlock. You can get a whole lot done, and you can change a whole lot of things, which, is sort of what America voted for this past Tuesday. And so you could put your agenda in place. The curse is that you can go too far in pressing an ideological agenda that the broad electorate, the broad citizenry, is not signed on to. And I use the example there of Obamacare. Last time we had total control by one party in Washington, we got Obamacare, an immensely unpopular measure forced through on a strict party line vote. And the result was 2010, when the Tea Party came in and swept most Democrats out of office, both in Washington and at the state level. So I think you have to act judiciously. You have to move carefully with that power, and you have to really try to get bipartisan input and bipartisan support for the things you're doing.
It's interesting. We've seen the same thing in Lansing, though, as well. One party, the Republicans have moved an awful lot of stuff since Rick Snyder came in, and since they've controlled both chambers of the House and the Senate. Back to Obamacare, though, with Obamacare as a cautionary tale, what's your advice to Republicans who want to repeal it and replace it?
Well, I think it has to be overhauled. You can call it the process whatever you want, but people can't continue getting 20-25% premium increases in the mail every fall. A lot of folks are being priced out of the insurance market. And if you think about the purpose of Obamacare, it was to broaden the access to insurance. And I guess it's done that on one end of the scale, but middle America is getting to the point where it can't afford insurance. When you have such high premiums match with high deductibles and high copays. You have people out there paying $1,000, $1,200 a month for insurance. And for middle America, that is a big hit. That makes it almost impossible to save for college or do anything else. And there's a lot of dissatisfaction about this. I would think this is one area you've got to fix. Paul Ryan's got the outline of a pretty good fix-it plan in his Better Way proposal, and I think that would be a good blueprint to get started. But Obamacare is not something that is working or that you can leave alone. There are elements the Republican Party will keep, but for the most part, you've got to make this thing affordable and rational, and you do that by attacking health care costs.
What do you make of Donald Trump's conciliatory comments here the last couple of days? I believe he made them to the Wall Street Journal about pre-existing conditions. He likes that provision. He likes the idea of young people staying on their parents' policies.
I think you're going to see a less rigid Donald Trump as he moves into the actuality of governing, and it starts to dawn on him that this is an enormous job. Nothing's going to be as easy as he made it sound on the campaign trail. He said he came to those conclusions after talking with President Obama in their first meeting. I think one thing I've heard over and over from Michigan people who have sat down with Donald Trump is that he does listen, that he's a good listener, asks good questions, and takes good advice. And I think that's going to be an essential quality as he moves forward to fix the many, many things that need fixing in this country. We've had a decade or more of stagnation, gridlock, and a lot of things have been put on the shelf. There's things that have to be done, and he's got to do them in the right way.
Our guest is Nolan Finley, editorial page editor at the Detroit News. How surprised were you that Donald Trump took Michigan?
I was surprised. Of course, I've been wrong at every turn in this election, so I shouldn't have been surprised by anything. I thought Michigan was closing as we headed into the election. All the polls indicated that, and certainly the candidates being here was on the very last day was a pretty good indication that Michigan was in play and very much in play. I think that Hillary Clinton did not do what she needed to do here in terms of getting out the Democratic base. Turnout in Flint and Detroit was light, much lighter than it was for Obama, and I think that's what made the difference. You know, I thought all along, and I have been writing all summer, that Hillary Clinton needed to pivot, stop spending all of her time bashing Donald Trump. People already knew what they didn't like about Donald Trump. What she failed to do in Michigan and elsewhere is tell people what they liked about her or what they should like about her. She never really talked about herself, her agenda, or tried to inspire people. She tried to scare people, and you know it almost worked for her, but it didn't.
How do Republican officials who rejected candidate Donald Trump or didn't speak up one way or the other, like Governor Snyder, how do you think they proceed now?
Well, I mean, they're in uncharted waters here. Usually when your party wins the presidency and you're a governor, you've been right there by his or her side, and you have a feeling of hope and optimism that you're going to benefit from that. In Michigan, neither Rick Snyder nor Lieutenant Governor Kelly supported Trump, and Bill Schuette did, but the relationship between Schuette and the governor's office isn't all that great. So I don't know who becomes the liaison to Donald Trump. I think Donald Trump does owe a debt to Michigan because they helped deliver him the election, our voters. And so I really think they're feeling their way on this.
Nationally, I thought it was so interesting to watch Speaker Paul Ryan respond to the ups and the downs of the Trump campaign and his notable reluctance to endorse Donald Trump, at least vigorously. There seemed to be something of a rapprochement here late last week. How Do you have any thoughts on how Trump and the Speaker are going to move forward?
Well, I was encouraged to see them standing together and talking about their joint plans. I think America needs Paul Ryan, Congress needs Paul Ryan, and Donald Trump needs Paul Ryan. He's a extraordinarily bright leader. He's got good ideas for the country, and he has demonstrated so far he can keep the sort of far-right element of his caucus in check, and I think he's done a masterful job as Speaker. I think he walked a very delicate path during this election, but he's the guy Donald Trump will need in Congress.
In your column yesterday, I noticed you wrote, "I believe Bernie Sanders could have beaten Trump or Vice President Joe Biden or any Democrat who offered voters straight talk and empathy." Can you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, there was a big, in my opinion, a big Hillary Clinton backlash in this election. A lot of people who might not have wanted to vote for Donald Trump simply couldn't vote for Hillary Clinton. They just knew too much about her and were not looking forward to the Clintons returning to the White House. And in a year when people were looking for somebody who was not part of the establishment or at least could speak to middle America, Democrats offered up Hillary Clinton, the ultimate insider, a person who hasn't driven a car in 40-some years, no connection to the average American at all. She's an elitist, and I think she could not speak to those voters. I think almost anybody else could have.
Back in Friday's paper, you urged President-elect Trump to signal that he's serious about working with women and minorities by nominating a woman or a minority for the Supreme Court. Let me ask you first, though, have you supported the Senate GOP leadership for refusing to consider President Obama's nominee, Merrick Garland, this year?
No, we wrote several times that Garland should be approved. He's qualified. He's moderate. I thought he was the best Supreme Court candidate you were going to get out of a Democratic administration, and we worried that Hillary Clinton would go much further left. And so I think it's for Donald Trump now to signal that he's truly going to be the president of all Americans. A woman or a minority would be an excellent way to demonstrate that as his appointment to the Supreme Court.
And explain, we're talking with Nolan Finley, editorial page editor at the Detroit News here on WKAR's Current State. Explain why you think Trump should pick someone like Michigan Supreme Court Justice Robert Young or Joan Larson.
Well, Young may, in truth, may be a little too old to be considered. I mean, presidents want somebody, you know, in their late 40s, early 50s who's going to be around the court for decades. And that's why I thought Joan Larson's a perfect pick. She meets all of the criteria. She's pro-life. She's conservative. But she's not strident. She's not frightening, I think, to the Democrats. And remember, they're still going to need 9 Democratic votes to get a nominee approved. And I think she would have an excellent chance of getting approval by the Senate. And is an excellent legal scholar and would make a good justice. And I think it would be a pick that sort of calms people.
How did your readers react to the paper's endorsement of Gary Johnson?
I mean, they were all over the place. We caught hell from Democrats. We caught hell from Republicans. There were very few people who didn't give us a good blistering during that process, but we did what we thought our conscience demanded.
How big a group is your editorial board? How many members on that?
There's 5 of us in that decision-making process.
And did you personally feel strongly about Johnson as endorsing him?
What I felt strongly about is that neither Donald Trump nor Hillary Clinton had the character to be president. I thought, as I described it in a personal column, not in that editorial, you know, the choice was between a lunatic and a liar. And at that point, we had Gary Johnson in, and he seemed the most reasonable of the three. This was before he had walked off the dock a couple of times, but even so, we felt that he had the character to be an honorable president.
What crosses your mind when you think about the rest of the Trump cabinet? I mean, granted, we've learned about two important appointments here just in the last couple of days. Where does your thinking take you when you consider who Trump might appoint, you know, Secretary of the Treasury and all those other important positions?
Well, my hope is that he appoints people who will begin dismantling this massive regulatory state that is throttling the economy, and that he will appoint people who will run these various departments of government, not as independent fiefdoms, making their own laws and imposing their own will on the American people, but responsive to the Congress and deferential to the Congress and to the lawmaking body. We have too many laws, in effect, being made by federal agencies, and I think it's one of the reasons people are frustrated and people are feeling that the government doesn't listen to them. Well, when you take away representative government, that's the impact.
Detroit News editorial page editor Nolan Finley has been our guest here on Current State. You can find his pre- and post-election columns at the Detroit News website, DetroitNews.com. Always a pleasure, Nolan. Thank you.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Coming up on Current State, meet MSU's new incoming member of the Board of Trustees, Clarkston's Dan Kelly, a Republican, won election last week. He cites college affordability as a key priority. Dan Kelly coming up on Current State. Let's shift gears, shall we? If you haven't heard, a new opportunity for fine dining can be found in Williamston at Gracie's Contemporary Bistro. Formerly known as Gracie's Place, the restaurant's been transitioning under new management this summer, and today is throwing a grand opening celebration. What a great way to start the week. Here to tell us about it, Gracie's General Manager, Emily Gray. Welcome, Emily.
Hi.
Congratulations. You must be dialed way up about this.
Oh, yeah,
this.
I'm geeked today.
The grand reopening is today, but Gracie's never actually closed. Do I have that right?
Correct. Yeah, we purchased at the end of June and took over as management at the beginning of July. They had three staff members, and so we retained all the staff members that they had, and we grew the business kind of from where it was at. We never closed, just tried to kind of fix anything that we saw that we could do. We brought in our parent restaurant is the Soup Spoon Cafe in Lansing on Michigan Avenue, which a lot of people will recognize. Same ownership. Nick Gavrilides is an amazing manager, amazing owner. And he took it over and we just kind of adjusted. You know, we've been making progress throughout the last couple of months. And we finally feel that we're at the point where we can reopen to the general public in a grand sense. We're also reopening on Mondays, which they had traditionally been closed on Mondays. So reopening to the public and kind of saying thank you to Williamson for welcoming us and, so on.
Where are you coming from? Are you coming from Soup Spoon or from Gracie's?
Nope, I'm both. I was at the Soup Spoon for almost 2 years. I've known Nick for 13 or 14 years back when he was a chef and we worked in Owosso. I'm from the DeWitt area. I actually graduated from here, this building, Commerce and Sciences.
Oh, really?
So Michigan State alumni, yep. And Nick came to me a couple of years ago and asked me if I wanted to be a part of the Soup Spoon. I said, absolutely. And then in July, he said, would you be interested in this new opportunity? We kind of want to expand to the Williamston area. And I said, oh, yeah, absolutely. I have family in Williamston, love the city, that small town mentality. It's just beautiful and quaint. The restaurant is just absolutely stunning. There wasn't a whole lot we had to do to the interior aesthetically. It's got tin ceilings and wood floors. It's just beautiful. We just had to work on service a little bit.
Talk to us about your vision for this, Gracie's 2.0, if you will,
yeah.
here. I mean, I think anytime anybody is in a situation like you're in, mm-hmm. and you inevitably you see opportunities.
Right.
You know, you say, we could do this a yeah. little bit better, or we could add that, or we could drop this.
Right.
What are those things at the top of that list for you?
Well, the top of it was we wanted it to be contemporary. We wanted it to be fine dining, and we want people to be able to come in and celebrate an anniversary or a special occasion, but we also want people to be able to come in after basketball practice and have a nice dinner or lunch. Our goals were to increase the consistency of the restaurant. We'd heard a lot of people say that they were concerned about consistency. We grew the staff, and we really excelled in that guest experience. That's what we wanted to focus on, was that guest experience and, you know, relationships that building in that area and so on and so forth. The other thing we brought that Gracie's had before, what we expanded on because we've had such a background in it with the Soup Spoon, is that farm-to-table feel. So we use a lot of local Mertz Meads and Bread Smith and Okemos and things like that, a lot of local vendors. And my two chefs, Ann Gavrilides and Josh Lane, just took that and ran. A lot of people expect the Soup Spoon menu. It's a little bit different. It's a little bit bolder, a little bit of different flavor. But we still stick with that farm-to-table feel. We try to do as local as possible.
What's the interior? Have you altered the interior of the restaurant at all?
Not greatly. It's a lot of... Like I said, it's very contemporary.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have to. The building was beautiful. The previous owners had did such an amazing job, and that was not really something that we needed to spend a majority of our focus on. So we have had all this time to build this exemplary menu. And
you're on Putnam, right?
On Putnam,
yeah,
South
yeah,
Putnam
yeah.
Street, yep. Right before you hit the light there and right
yeah.
in downtown.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and it's been wonderful. I mean, it's been a wild ride since July. We built a staff. We went from 3 people to almost 25. We have, you know, our chefs are just amazing. They do some amazing stuff with food. So we have very similar things like the lamb shank at the Soup Spoon. We'll also find at Gracie's, but it's different. It's got, a different flavor to it.
Is that a signature dish?
You'll find it at both. The lamb shank is one of the, I mean, it's a huge lamb shank. It's really impressive to see and to have plated in front of you. When it arrives, a lot of people go, whoa, you know, that's a lot of food. So it's the same style, but the presentation is different. And Nick, the owner, is an amazing, amazing owner when it comes to presentation of food. And obviously he was a chef before, and it's so much fun to work for both restaurants, but the Gracie's is a lot smaller than Soup Spoon. It's a lot more quaint, a lot more hands-on, I guess. You're right in the middle of everything all the time. Mm-hmm. You don't have a choice. It's tiny. So we work in really tiny kitchens out of both restaurants, and they whip out some amazing food. So hopefully some people can make it out, especially today to that grand reopening. We're going to be doing stuff all day long. We have a ribbon-cutting ceremony with the Chamber of Commerce at 11, so I'm going to be running as fast as I can to get there. We have the ribbon-cutting ceremony. We have a champagne toast at 7 o'clock tonight. So we're encouraging people to make reservations, and we do. We take reservations all day long.
Nice.
Which is, yeah.
I'm speaking with Emily Gray, General Manager of Gracie's Contemporary Bistro in Williamston. They're hosting a grand reopening celebration today starting at 11 and going till 10 o'clock tonight. What about the drink offerings here? Local beers, local wines?
We do. We have Shorts Brewing, Bell's Brewing, Ellison Brewery in Lansing, which is a relatively new brewery here that a lot of people know and love. And then we also have our own beer that Old Nation in Williamston just created for us. It's called Saying Grace. And it's going to be on tap all the time. So all of our current lineup, and we don't pigeonhole to just the Michigan breweries like the Soup Spoon does, but right now that's what we have on our draft lines. We have 6 different drafts, so that's all Michigan based right now. And then our bar is headed by my master mixologist, James Hodge, and he will be there all day today. He does an apothecary style bar. So you'll find, if you walk into the bar and you take a look at our back bar, a lot of people look and they see, you know, the Captain Morgans and the Bacardis and all that.
Mm-hmm.
You don't see a lot of that. You see a lot of Fernet Branca. You see Saint Germain. You see Herb Saint. Things that a lot of people haven't heard of since pre-Prohibition times. So that's what we do. We make all of our own grenadines and things like that. He makes them. Hmm. I mean, that's his passion. So,
how do you feel about the competitive landscape here? I mean, Williamston has its share of choices these days.
It does.
It's a very vibrant scene.
It does. It's very vibrant, especially with the brewery there and everything else. Our biggest thing is we offer a little bit different than what everybody else offers. You have some really fine dining establishments there, and we have made a point to become friends with those places. I mean, my cooks will go over to Tavern 109 and hang out there, and they'll come to our restaurant, things like that. Our biggest thing is not so much to compete, but we do our own thing. It's a very different feel from the other restaurants that you're going to get in the Williamston area.
Emily Gray is general manager of Gracie's Contemporary Bistro in Williamston. Gracie's is hosting a grand reopening celebration today, 11 a.m. to 10 p.m. tonight. Emily, good luck.
Thank you.
Happy and excited for you.
Yep,
thank
you for being here. Supermoon's going to be great.
And coming up on Current State, they've done it. The MSU football team finally won a Big Ten game, topping Rutgers on Saturday. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about what's ahead. We'll talk about the Michigan loss and three MSU basketball games later this hour with Current Sports. Al Martin, that's on the way. It is Monday here on Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Glad you could join us today. We are on WKAR 7 days a week, and Monday through Friday, three times every day, 9 a.m. and 6 p.m. on 90.5, at noon every day on AM 870, and we can always be heard at WKAR.org. Our next guest was elected last week to the MSU Board of Trustees. Dan Kelly is an attorney from Clarkston in Oakland County, a Republican who considers his primary responsibility to ensure fiscal soundness, fiscal responsibility at MSU to keep tuition affordable. Mr. Kelly served as a township trustee and as a trustee at Oakland Community College's Board of Trustees. Dan Kelly, welcome to Current State.
Good morning, Mark.
How are you? Congratulations.
Well, thank you very much.
How does it feel to win a seat on the board of your alma mater?
Well, good. Good. It's actually not my alma mater, but
I beg your pardon. I misunderstood.
Yeah, I've got a daughter that graduated from there, and I've got two daughters there and probably a son on his way.
Okay. And why did you want to serve as a trustee? Why are you signing on for this?
Well, I've got a lot of experience in the area. I've sat on, as you said, an Independence Township Board for 8 years. I've sat on Oakland Community College Board of Trustees for 6 years, and I was also the chair of Oakland Community College. And then in my professional life, I've been a municipal and school district attorney. So there's not too many weeks that go by that I'm not at a board meeting of some sort. So it was really the experience that I had, and I thought that I could give that experience to MSU.
On your website, you emphasize the student comes first, and you go on to make it pretty clear that MSU's recent tuition increases is a concern for you. Just tell us more about that.
Sure. What I did to get ready for the campaign and to understand the college, over the last year and a half, I've kind of looked at, obviously, the tuition increases, which, and I've said this many times, tuition increase is not the problem. Tuition increase is the chosen solution. The real problem is the increase in expenditures that forces that tuition increase. And obviously, over the last 10 years, we've had significant expenditure increases, which have led to those tuition increases. We've also, at the same time, had reductions from the contributions from the state legislature, and that has kind of leveled out, which has also put a lot of pressure on the tuition. So those two factors are the main reasons, and if we're going to do anything about the increasing tuition, we have to try to work on both of those. And I've got a plan to do both, and I'm anxious to get started on it.
When you were out campaigning, did the people that you spoke with, did they typically respond in a supportive way to that line of reasoning that we just heard from you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And really, it's a bipartisan effort. Miss Byram, who actually is the Democrat who was elected with me last week, and she was reelected. She was an incumbent. I think her statements to the press have been the same thing, which is we've got to keep an eye on tuition and accessibility. So I think that we need to, as board, be active in trying to work with the legislature as well as the administration to try to really hone in on, can we do something with this tuition? And there's some things out there. All Big Ten schools are faced with these issues. Ohio State, for example, has kind of it's interesting I'm bringing up Ohio State this week, but they have an interesting relationship with their state legislature that if they don't increase tuition, there's a formula that the state legislature contributes more to the college. So those are some things that we need to look at here in Michigan, and hopefully the legislature is receptive to that.
Do you think MSU is, I guess the verb I would use is entitled. Do you feel MSU is entitled to more state aid?
Well, I think that MSU holds a unique position in the state. It is a land-grant university. It was for the purposes of teaching a practical education to the students of Michigan. The problem with these tuition and the expenditure increases is that it puts a number of pressures on the college. One of them, obviously, to increase tuition, but also to try to get revenue from other areas. And what that means is an increase in out-of-state students who pay three times the underlying tuition. So there's a definite trend to increasing out-of-state students, and that has to be looked at as well. And that's the downside of trying to get more revenue. So I think that the legislature could be approached on the grounds that our goal here is to teach your residents and your citizens in Michigan. And in order for us to do that, we need some more help. And I think that is consistent with what the state legislature should be looking at.
We're talking with Dan Kelly of Clarkston, Michigan. Dan's an attorney who last Tuesday was elected to MSU's Board of Trustees. Also on your website, you appear to be a critic of unions and of the left just generally. I mean, the university has plenty of unionized employees, faculty, staff, tons of people. And like most universities, it's politically a pretty liberal place, to be sure. Would you try to change that or impact that in some way as a trustee?
I know what you're referring to, but I'm not critical of unions. I respect the collective bargaining process. When I was in college, I was a member of the UAW to pay my way through college, and my parents have been UAW members. So it's not that I'm critical of unions. What I was concerned about is that the influence that unions have on particularly education boards, and it's really a perception. I don't believe that union presidents, people who have a direct connection with the union of the same entity that represents the employees, should also be sitting over the collective bargaining process. And what I've said is that you can't have the union on both sides of the collective bargaining negotiating table. So that's my concern. I think that, quite frankly, with my election, we've been able to, ease that perception. And so I am interested in taking a look at those collective bargaining agreements, not necessarily because I think that employees of MSU are being overpaid. I don't know that. I need to delve into the data. But the truth of the matter, like any public institution, your labor expenses, wages and benefits, are usually around 72 to 75% of your total costs. So if you're going to do anything about increasing budgets and expenditures, you have to take a look at those costs.
You've made it clear that you intend to learn more about MSU before your tenure on the board begins. What other kinds of things do you feel you'd really like to learn more about?
Well, for me, I think the number one priority of any board is the budget. Everything basically flows from the budget. So I'm anxious. I've already been contacted by the administration of MSU. We're in the process of scheduling some orientation days before January 1st, where I take that oath of office. And that's what I'm primarily looking at. Now, I will definitely look at the policies and procedures of the college, but to really get up to speed, it's to understand the budget, to understand what flexibility we have in the budget. And so that's my number one priority, is to get into the numbers.
Are you acquainted with any board members now?
I've met many of them, and since my election last week, I've talked to, I think, five of the board members. But I had met probably four or five beforehand as well.
We've all had a long time to get to know Lou Anna Simon in the president's role. What do you make of her tenure? What kind of president do you think she's been?
I think she's been outstanding, great. I think the university has thrived under her. I think that it's headed in the right direction from a national perspective. So I think she's done a great job.
Dan Kelly is our guest. Dan is from Clarkston in Oakland County. He last Tuesday was elected to MSU's Board of Trustees. Dan, when you were out campaigning and you explained that you were a candidate for MSU trustee, what was the most common question that you got or question or comment?
Sure. Lots of questions about the increasing tuition. A lot of questions about the rising number of out-of-state students, questions about the liberal bias, as it's been referred to, in our universities. And those are just general questions. So I would say that those are probably the three top issues that I was asked about.
Did you get the impression that the broader public follows the administration of, well, not just of MSU, but of the state's other public universities? Were you surprised by how closely they followed it, or was it about what you expected? What?
I would think it was about what I expected. I don't think that we're the number one priority on any ballot when board members run. Whenever I was asked to speak, I generally would start the speech with basically the total annual expenditures of the college to give everybody an idea of just how big the university is. MSU has a budget or an expenditures of about $1.3 to $1.4 billion dollars. That's a lot of money. And so that does get people's attention when you say that, you know, here we have an entity that's spending that much money every year with an annual budget. So that's how I got people's interest. But I would think that I expected most people to, if they have kids there or they're attending there, then obviously they have an interest. But most voters don't have a specific knowledge of what the issues are. Hmm.
I'd like to ask you about your experience as an Oakland Community College trustee. What would you say, how would you describe what you learned from those years on the board?
Well, all higher education in the state of Michigan pretty much operate the same way from an internal perspective. I've always said that I'm an oversight. I am not the day-to-day operations of, in the case of Oakland Community College or as to MSU. That's the administration's job. Now, OCC, the community college, is funded a little differently. It's funded on property taxes. And so there's a fluctuation in property taxes. If property is going up, OCC earns more money. That's not necessarily the case with MSU. MSU is dependent upon subsidies from the state, and then the rest of it is based upon tuition and what they generate by way of revenue. So the funding mechanisms for the two colleges are completely different. But as to the practical issues of what's facing the safety, making sure that there is, the proper level of education and concepts like shared governance and academic freedom, those are the same issues that I dealt with at OCC, and I'm sure the same issues and pressures are at MSU.
Dan Kelly's been our guest. Dan is an attorney from Clarkston in Oakland County, a Republican who was elected last week to the MSU Board of Trustees. We wish you well, Dan Kelly. Thanks for joining us.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much, Mark. Have a good day.
Well, the MSU football team hasn't given its fans much reason to smile this year. However, on Saturday, there were a lot of pearly green and whites grinning from ear to ear. The Spartans shut out lowly Rutgers 49-0, marking the fourth time in the Mark D'Antonio era that his defense has allowed no points. On the flip side, the top tier of the college football world experienced a shakeup. Three of the top four teams were upset, including Michigan. Current sports host Al Martin joins me to recap. Hi, Al.
Mark, how are you doing?
I'm just great. Let's start with MSU football. How do you explain all the offense we saw on Saturday? Where have they been keeping that?
Well, I tell you what. First off, they're playing Rutgers. So let's temper the emotion just a bit here. I mean, this is a team that approached this game with the same exact record of 2-7, the same record that Michigan State had entering this matchup against the Spartans, and you know, two teams that are winless in the Big Ten. So let's pump the brakes just a bit here. But I will say, and I've said this all year about the Michigan State offense, when it comes to Tyler O'Connor and his comfortability in the pocket, he needs to have a solid run game in order to put the pressure off of him just a bit and to just ease into the offense. I mean, when you look at it, you look at LJ Scott. He ran 20 times, 122 yards, Mark, and a touchdown. Gerald Holmes and Madre London each had 9 carries, 52 yards. Michigan State total had 277 yards on the ground. Mm. That's the most they've had on the ground the entire year. So really, when you look at it, Tyler O'Connor just really needs just to settle in and not make mistakes when he is allowed to throw, when that play call does come through. He only threw 15 times, but they were efficient. 15 times, 3 touchdowns. I mean, that's pretty good. Mm-hmm. So I always say when Michigan State has a balanced running attack mixed in with Tyler O'Connor, it usually ends up in success.
How surprising was it that we shut Rutgers out, considering the injuries and all?
If anything, that was the surprising factor for me, Mark. I mean, the first defensive shutout since 2013 when they beat Purdue 14-0 held Rutgers to just 149 yards total offense. They forced 5 3 and outs, 2 interceptions, one that was taken to the house with senior captain Demetrius Cox, and also made Rutgers punt 9 times throughout that game. And then you have, you know, the added storyline before this game in Malik McDowell being injured and not playing. You know, a lot of people look at Malik McDowell as a possible first-round pick in this year's upcoming NFL draft. You have true freshies and Josh King and Mike Panasiuk receiving first career starts on that defensive line. They played fantastic. And I think this does a lot confidence-wise for that defense, considering the fact they've given up many big plays throughout this year, Mark.
Ohio State and Penn State, the two remaining games left to play, our odds can't seem to be too good against Ohio State. What are the chances we can find a win there?
Yeah, it's going to be tough. You know, Ohio State and Penn State have had great years thus far. Ohio State, get this, Mark, they won the past two games over both Maryland and Nebraska by a combined score of 124 to just 6. They've only allowed 6 points in the last 2 weeks, Mark. Mm. So it seems as though they've come off that loss to another team that Michigan State is playing at the very end of the year in Penn State. Penn State upset Ohio State, if you remember, back in October. They've come off that loss just really with the mindset, okay, we got to win out here if we want to be in that number to possibly make a college football playoff appearance. Penn State has only lost to Pitt, who upset Clemson over the weekend, and also Stout Michigan. Those are the only two losses that the Nittany Lions have. So it's a tall order to expect Sparty to close out these final 2 weeks with a win, but I do expect them to be competitive in both of these games.
Current sports, Al Martin is our guest. We're recapping MSU football, Big Ten football, and some basketball to talk about here in just a minute. Let's talk about the Michigan road defeat. They went down at Iowa City with time winding down. What's the impact of that on their postseason playoff chances?
They still, believe it or not, they still have their goals in front of them, Mark. I mean, it's still one loss on the year. Michigan, if you look at the Associated Press college football poll that was released yesterday, Michigan is still in the top four. They actually rank at number 4 when you look at that poll. Now, again, tomorrow night we'll see another college football playoff committee poll released, and a lot of people do expect Michigan to still be in that number. Michigan can still win the Big Ten East. They play Indiana on Saturday and then go to Ohio State for that big matchup to close out the year. Wilton Spate, though, when you look at that loss against Iowa on the road, Mark, Wilton Spate was the key for me. Quarterback for U of M. 11 of 26 for 103 yards, an interception. He was sacked twice, completed just 42.3% of his passes. That is his lowest percentage, his lowest completion percentage this entire year. He knows he has to play better, and that offensive line has to protect him better if they want to close out the division.
Did Iowa do anything else that enabled them to do what no other team has been able to do yet?
Certainly. I have to say this, too. I've been one of those who have said that Michigan has still, approaching that Iowa game, Michigan had still not been tested truly on the road. In my opinion, I've been saying this all season. They played a lollipop schedule, all right? And finally, they go on the road to play a team like Iowa, who's going to hit you in the mouth. I mean, Iowa is a team that, of course, played Michigan State in the Big Ten Championship last year. They have a lot of guys who can fly around defensively. They swarmed the quarterback, got a lot of hits on Wilton Spate. And you factor that in, that you're playing them on the road. Eventually, you know, they were able to win out in the final seconds of that game. And I wasn't surprised.
And we saw three of the top four teams fall over the weekend. Historically, how uncommon is that?
I got a stat for you. Get this, Mark. So, again, Michigan lost to Iowa, as we just stated. Clemson lost at home to Pitt. Pat Narduzzi, former defensive coordinator, head coach at Pitt. Another big win for him this year. My goodness, right? Washington lost at home to USC. First time the AP 2 through 4 lost on the same day since 1985. Now get this. During that week in 1985, guess who was the head quarterback at U of M who was a part of one of those losses?
Harbaugh.
Jim Harbaugh was the head coach at Michigan in 1985 when number 2 Michigan fell to number 1 Iowa. Sound familiar? And they lost on a last-second field goal.
Oh, my gosh.
Talk about deja vu, right?
How about that? Several MSU basketball games to look back on just this weekend. What do you take from the men's loss to Arizona?
Yeah, well, that was, first off, one heck of a game. Heck of a game that came down to the wire, and it just shows you how it's all about the little things. In every sport, let alone college basketball, on that final play, Michigan State lets Kadeem Allen go the full length of the court. Josh Langford's guarding him. Allen goes right by him. Miles Bridges tries to contest the shot. He's late on it. Kenny Goins is above the key. He should have been in the paint to contest the shot as well. It ended up being a game-winning layup that beats Michigan State men's basketball. But when you look at it, I mean, my goodness, Miles Bridges is a name that is going to be household this entire season. Bar injury, this kid, I think, can be a one-and-done player. Again, we've still got a lot of college basketball left to play. But what he did against Arizona in Hawaii in the Armed Forces Classic was just a little taste of what this kid can do the entire year. So I'm looking forward to seeing what this team can do. Again, Izzo is known for being top-heavy with his schedule. So tomorrow they actually play Kentucky. And, I mean, Kentucky is the number 2 team in the nation. I mean, it's realistic to kind of think here and kind of throw it around that Michigan State men's basketball can start the year 0-2. But at the same time, look at the teams they played, you know? Yeah. Izzo's known for that. He likes to see where the holes in the boat are very early so he can figure out how to plug them as the year goes on.
And the women are 2-0. Can we expect a lot more of this, or are there bigger challenges ahead for the Spartan women?
Well, certainly bigger challenges ahead, Mark. I mean, because we're talking about the very start of the year for them. They've yet to start even Big Ten play, but they beat Davidson on Friday, Wyoming yesterday. They play Southern University tomorrow, so a quick turnaround. But there's a lot of things, a lot of pieces on this team that are encouraging, including Taya Reimer, I mean, who's been really lighting it up. And I'm really interested to see that championship mentality that she brings from Notre Dame.
We got about 30 seconds, Al. Some big news was also released about the Western Michigan Bronco football team over the weekend. Briefly, can you tell us how the Broncos will be in the national spotlight this week?
Yes, WMU beat Kent State 37-21 to make it 10-0 for the year. College Game Day, ESPN's College Game Day, coming to Kalamazoo for the first time ever. The number 21 Broncos, along with Alabama, are the only unbeatens in the college football world. Unbelievable.
How exciting.
Row the boat.
That's great. Al Martin, more from Al on Current Sports today at 1 p.m. every weekday at 1 on AM 870. Thank you, Al. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you.
Good fun. That's our show for today. Tomorrow on Current State, get a preview of the MSU College of Music's production of the comedic opera, The Elixir of Love. It involves the romantic antics regarding a potion of sorts, which makes people fall in love with you. Spoiler alert, the potion is actually a bottle of wine. That and more tomorrow on Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Wharf. Katie Cook directed our show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Kevin Lavery, Jamie Paisley, Brooke Allen, and to Drew Hill. And the musical world lost a tremendous performer and songwriter over the weekend. Leon Russell died in his sleep at the age of 74. We leave you with one of his greatest, A Song for You. Have a good day. Well, there's no space and time. I love you for my life, you are a friend of mine. And when my life's over, remember when we were together. We were alone and now we're singing this song for you. We were alone and now we're singing this song for you. We were alone and now we're singing my song. Singing this song for you.